WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are positively back down at our original home, Don Mohler. We're not reconning there. We actually have, like, live guests. I brought my mask because I've been wearing it. I'm letting myself play. It's all brought to you by the Maryland Lottery. We're doing the crab cake tour. It's about a third of a crab cake left here. You know, we got after this thing here a little bit.
Yeah, he sort of went after it, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, you know, we're doing what we're doing here. Don, it's been a long time. We've had so many guests that we wanted to have out at State Fair here, Costas, the place we... And then it all stopped, you know. March of 2020, live stop.
March 13th. We'll never forget it. Well, here's the crazy part. Nestor, to our guest, walked in this morning. You talk about pre-pandemic, post-pandemic. Our guest says to you, it's great to see you in person. We have not...
I've never met Ben Jealous.
We have not been together with our guest, my good buddy, former gubernatorial candidate in the state of Maryland.
Well, Don, you and I have. I've been in your backyard.
Yes, you have.
Nestor's always been a guy on Zoom to me. So.
Former president.
I'm real. The hair's real.
That's right. It's real,
and it's fantastic. That's
a judgment call.
Yeah.
Former president of the NAACP and currently president and CEO of People for the American Way. How are you, man?
I'm good, brother.
Good.
I'm really good.
Good to see you. First of all, catch us up on your family. You're always telling stories about your son and all the good things going on. What's going on with the family?
Well, first of all, my daughter, who got her start with Baltimore City Rowing. There's a great rowing club down in Cherry Hill. She started there.
I see it right on the water.
My daughter started in seventh grade. And the, you know, I rowed in college. There's very few black rowers. But she got a great start here. It was actually the college admissions scandal. I've been telling my daughter her whole child, look, you should row. It's going to help you get into a great college. And then she comes to me one day and says, Dad, these rich people, they spend $600,000 to pretend their children are rowers. Maybe I should try it.
So
I called Baltimore City Parks and Rec, got her started. She's now a sophomore. She's 6 feet tall.
So she might get into Stanford or USC legitimately.
For a woman rower to be six feet tall, because it's a leg sport, it's like a guy basketball player to be 6'8".
Okay.
So she's right there.
Volleyball is also built for rowing in a good way.
And like most running. But like, honestly, if you're a second-rate runner, you can be a first-rate rower. That's what I tell kids all the time. So she's rowing. My son, Jack, picked up a guitar when he was 8 years old at the start of COVID. Hasn't put it down. His hero is Slash from Guns N' Roses.
Good hero to have.
Yeah, he's like, Slash plays an hour a day. I'll play an hour a day. And the crazy thing is I named him Jack Jealous because it sounded a bit like Jack Johnson. Like, it sounded kind of like a rock star name. And, you know, dad's like kind of closet ambitious child to be a rock star. I never said that to him. But this year he stood up in front of his fourth grade class. He said, my name is Jack Jealous. I'm going to be a rock star. I was like,
there you go.
There you go.
Wow. So if we brought Jack Jealous in here right now, what would be the song that he would fire up for us?
You know, the other day he was playing Storm on the Water. Smoke on the Water?
Smoke on the Water.
That's
the first drink. But here's the crazy thing. He was playing it he had never touched an upright bass before. This has a fretless upright bass. My kid plays a guitar. He walked right over to it.
So this is like Stray Cats?
He just started banging out Smoke on the Water on an upright bass, having never touched one before.
Now, when you look at the family history, I always like to ask when I hear something like that. He's obviously talented.
Yeah.
Obviously has a knack for it. When you go back into your family tree, musical ability in that family tree?
Yeah, 100%. My grandfather, who was a probation officer here in the city at the end of his career, but throughout his career, including when he was the executive porter for the president of the B&O Railroad, was always a jazz clarinetist who played in the clubs around Baltimore. You go back into slavery, our family were musicians down in Virginia. In fact, my grandmother turns 105 next week. She was Barbara Mikulski's mentor as a social worker. And my grandmother figured out that my grandfather's dad's string band played at her parents' family wedding. So the family has been...
We're talking about 40s, 50s? Where are we talking about here?
No, I mean, her parents' wedding would have been like 1908.
Whoa!
You know?
We're going way back.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think with your kid with Smoke on the Water, it's Deep Purple.
Yes.
In Baltimore with the Ravens. Maybe he likes Deep Purple?
Yeah, he is definitely a Ravens fan.
Well, there you go. It's another reason to love Smoke on the Water.
And the crazy thing is his uncle was the music reporter for Time Magazine for 10 years. He hears my son playing Smoke on the Water. He's like... You know, wow, the kid can play Led Zeppelin. He's like, Uncle Chris, it's Deep Purple.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, I was going to say, play some Zeppelin before it's all over. Ben Jealous is our guest.
Good for him.
We're doing a crab cake tour, and so many things to talk about here. Don, he green rooms. He puts acts like you guys were actually in power.
It's a crazy concept, and our listeners have become familiar with it over 3 years. It's actually called preparation.
No.
It's called preparation.
It doesn't make good radio that way. He doesn't understand this.
So get us up to speed. You know, some folks may be hearing you on the show for the first time, Ben. You've been on a number of times. But catch us up to date on People for the American Way.
Yeah.
What you're doing and what it's all about. So people say, Ben's with People for... What the heck is that?
Yeah. So People for the American Way was started by Congresswoman Barbara Jordan and Norman Lear, the guy who brought us Good Times and Facts of Life and Maude.
One of the great Americans of all,
incredible.
Norman Lear,
I mean, Norman flew 52 bomber missions in World War II as a gunner on the top wing. And, I mean, he's just a, incredible.
And then wrote Archie Bunker's character, as well as Maude and, a whole bunch of others.
Yeah, and Good Times, and, Sanford and Son, and, all that TV show. I mean, I was a latchkey kid in the 80s, so I've seen all of his shows, over and over and over.
I live like George Jefferson, top of Harbor Court.
You mentioned, I'm going to come back, we're going to jump right back in, but I'll lose it if I don't say it. You mentioned Barbara Jordan.
Yeah.
I want to tell you. You know, I'm older than you are, certainly older than Nestor. As a young 20-something, my iconic, and I think I'll get this right, Barbara Jordan moment, is at the Watergate hearings when she gives this incredible speech about we the people.
Yes.
And when this document was written, you need to know that I wasn't part of the we the people. I'm getting goosebumps again now. And I can just see Barbara Jordan in that powerful voice.
Well, and then she would say, and what do the American people want? The American people want a nation as good as its promise.
Ooh.
Yeah, yeah. She was
and that's
remarkable.
That's what we, People for the American Way was founded to really pull people together across every line. Barbara's from the South. Norman's from the North. Barbara's black. Norman's white. Barbara's Christian. Norman's Jewish. Barbara's black. He's white. Just pull folks together. We founded in 1981 at a time when, quite frankly, there was a lot of clergy who were tearing our nation apart. People like Pat Robertson, people like Jerry Falwell, right? To really organize the people of this country to stand up. And so the founding ad for People for the American Way was a Archie Bunker type character. It was like a white guy who was a construction worker who was taking issue with a letter that had been sent out by Jerry Falwell that basically said, you aren't a good Christian if you don't vote for this person, that person, whatever. And he basically was like, look, I agree with you, but how dare you suggest that my wife's not a good Christian because of this, and my son's not a good Christian because of that. Like, somehow they're not right with God if they don't think the way that you think. That's the most and so that's fundamentally, what we're about is an organization.
So it's a 40-year-old organization.
40-year-old organization. Wow. Right. And I thought I was out of civil rights, when you step down as
president. You're never out of civil rights.
Yeah, but I mean,
come
professionally.
On.
I mean, I'm a fifth-generation member of the NAACP. My mom
lived up the street.
Yeah, well, my grandma used to watch the Mitchell kids when Juanita was the branch president. Juanita Jackson Mitchell, her mom had been branch president here. So my, any issues you have with Kiefer, you can take up with my grandma.
Kiefer. We don't always like the point of view that Kiefer's taking
out.
We like Kiefer.
No,
Kiefer and I
family.
Argue about important things marshmallow on snowballs.
Yes,
things like that.
Right. Stick to the simple stuff.
Right, or the best way to make orange juice.
There you go.
He's really good at it. I've had a lot of orange
good.
Juice.
He is quite good. He's a decent man, and my grandma was the only one, and she's on my mind a lot because she turns 105 next week, was the only one that his mom his grandma would let watch his dad and his uncles, and then my grandma watched him too.
Well, so we've got, how does it, before I transition to what's going on in the crazy world today, give our folks, the four dummies, give us an example of how People for the American Way is trying to make us better.
Okay. So we do a couple of things. One is right now we've totally plugged in the judicial nominations process. A lot of what we do is make sure that there's a bench of folks being recruited to be federal judges who represent the entire country, frankly, are not just corporate lawyers. They're not just there to do the bidding of the corporations, but there to do the bidding of the people. They're women, they're people.
Well, the Rittenhouse thing last week, you know, brings up when you have judges that are predisposed, right?
Yes. Yeah. No, exactly. You know, they're defense attorneys, they're not just prosecutors. Like, you need the full range in our
judiciary. When did this whole
judiciary.
Stacking the courts thing become like a topic, right? I mean, I guess it's always been
well,
there.
The
it's been more subtle.
It's always been there.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, really, there was a deal with the devil, if you get right down to it. The old Dixiecrats, for a moment, were like a group without a party. They're being pushed out of the Democrats.
Post-LBJ.
Yeah, post-LBJ. And you had some young Republican operatives like Karl Rove, who figured that the most conservative judges, the judges that were willing to wage their culture war, if you will, against the people of this country, were also the most likely to be lenient on corporations. And so they went to corporations and they said, look, we want you to invest in running all these folks at the county level for judge because they'll be business-friendly judges. They also are like a complete terror when it comes to civil rights, to women's rights, to workers' rights, any of that. And that was really the beginning of creating this massive far right wing movement to really stack the courts, and not just the Supreme Court. I mean, like county court all the way up, with people who, frankly, have a real issue with freedom and have a real issue with workers' rights. And again, the corporations would write the checks because they would be business friendly, but not to small businesses. You know, we're talking about corporate friendly judges who happen to also be right of Attila the Hun.
Yeah, the left-right thing is where's the center? Like I heard someone last week, we're a right-center country. Everything we hear about guns, 80%, 90% of people, and the senatorial issues in the smaller states really sort of weigh things differently for how liberal we really are and what we want for our children, for safety. I just spent the day in my old elementary school that Johnny O dedicated on Tuesday. We've been talking about Colgate Elementary over in Dundalk at length here. But
let's talk about South Baltimore and West Baltimore for a second, right? Like, this is where our
sure.
families are from,
okay.
right? And they're roughly mirror images of each other. I mean, the reality is, like, when Bethlehem Steel shut down, everybody got fucked, right? I mean,
right.
just real talk. And, you know, but I would say one of the, if you go back in our country 80 years, say, or 90 years, Great Depression. Poverty in the white community was visible. Since the civil rights movement, media has only wanted to portray struggling people as black and brown. And there's always been more struggling white people than there are struggling black folks because
there are more of them.
You know, four times the population.
Right.
Right. And so, but when you, the thing is that when you race the poor, when you make the image of the poor in people's minds black and brown, like
certainly
everybody gets shortchanged.
Right.
But I mean, in the country, that's the image. Everybody gets shortchanged. And when you flip it, when you actually make poverty visible as it is, all of a sudden what people are willing to do changes. I'll give you an example. Baltimore's had a heroin epidemic for as long as I've been alive, if not twice as long. The heroin epidemic, as far as I can tell, goes back like World War I. I mean, it goes back a long ways. As long as we were talking about sort of heroin and, you know, they would show the images of who was getting arrested, the images of black folks.
Who's dealing it? Who's selling it?
Yeah, all of that. And yet, everybody kind of knew in the back of their mind it wasn't completely true, right? I mean, you take, like, crack. The biggest cohort of crack users were always middle-aged, middle-class white men in the suburbs. But you know what? They're hard to catch, right? So black folks, the projects, like shooting fish in a barrel. Drug use in our society tends to be pretty much even across communities. Here's the thing. As soon as sheriffs in the Midwest and the South started showing images of who was dying of opiate overdose in their communities, which were a lot of white mothers who were taking pills. Sometimes they were dying in the front seat of a car with kids in the frickin', you know, strapped in the back. All of a sudden, we went from having a criminal justice problem to having a health problem, as we should have all along. Like addiction, if you've ever had an addict in your family or in your life, you know.
Well, I did a big piece with Rally last week with Kathy Perry Hall. Give me your name. Councilwoman, Senator Kathy Klausmeier. Thank you.
Oh, okay.
I had her on last week. My bad. And we were just discussing how this got to Annapolis, and this was something people all over the state could get behind.
Yes.
Because the opioid addiction is something that is
the first
now being addressed.
Is you had to make the white victims of it visible. Right, and that's kind of an impolitic thing to say, but it's 100% true. If you look at before the sheriffs began showing who was dying, where public opinion was, it was way the heck over on the right. As soon as America saw that the people dying from it looked like all of America, which means that they look disproportionately white because whites are the biggest group of folks in our society, public opinion, frankly, swung to the left. It just swung to be more reasonable. Because all of a sudden we realized we were talking about all of us.
Well, I had heard about Narcan until a couple years ago, right?
Well,
I
mean, and Kathy Klausmeier was a big advocate and supporter of legislation to make that more accessible. But your point is so well taken, Ben. You know, it's interesting. Right now there's a show that's getting tremendous buzz on Hulu called Dope Sick. You know, it's Michael Keaton, and it's about the whole Purdue Pharma and their effort to basically lie to the American people all across the country that OxyContin was not addictive. It was basically nothing more than taking a couple of Advil. And the focus of this story, true story, is they started in the poor areas and counties in West Virginia.
Yeah.
And that's where they grew the base. And I haven't had one person in my circle yet who's seen it who doesn't say, every one of those guys should be locked up forever, every one of them. So they get that. But this whole discussion, Ben, brings us back to something that I've spent an inordinate amount of time on, and I don't have the answer yet, and that is this identity crisis for the Democratic Party. And I'm going to lay out a couple of things. There's going to be a lot in here, and I'm going to ask you to try to make sense of it. Because I think you're front and center of it in some ways, particularly as we go toward a gubernatorial primary in Maryland for governor again. Virginia and New Jersey have once again scared the bejesus out of Democrats. They look at that, and the initial reaction is, and I've written some about it, the initial reaction is every time, I think it's much more complicated than this, but the initial reaction, every time the Democrats lurch to the left, they lose, and that we are a center, or if anything, slightly center-right country, and we need candidates dead smack dab in the center. Now, I don't necessarily disagree, and this is where I want you to jump in, because you certainly had to fight back and unfortunately didn't have the money to tell the story that we needed to tell. And I always say to Nestor, you can have all the wonderful thoughts in the world. If you don't have that $20 million to run for governor, just go have a beer somewhere.
Chris Van Hollen's going to run into that right now, too.
Right.
I'm terrified about Chris. If the election was held today, Hogan would beat Chris by 20 points.
Yeah, see, that's...
And so what people don't understand, like you and I talk about this kind of inside baseball, and you say, well, I fell $10 million short. Like, what the fuck is he talking about? It's simply this. I got to like 70, 75% of the voters knowing who I was. The governor was at 100%.
Right.
If you say to a marketing person, how much is it going to cost for me to get 100% name ID starting out at 70, 75, they'll tell you in Maryland, in the political season, about $10 million.
Right.
And what's going on right now is Chris Van Hollen's doing an incredible job, deeply respected in the state, outside the state.
One of the finest senators in the United States Senate.
Period. But two-thirds to three-quarters of the people know who he is.
Right.
And the other quarter to a third of voters don't know who he is. And Larry Hogan is so well handled that he runs in a way that he's inoffensive to people. And so that quarter to a third will kill your campaign. Well, if they don't know who you are, people don't buy what they don't know.
Well, he feeds into, this is a terrific discussion. Again, we're with Ben Jealous, former gubernatorial candidate in the state of Maryland, presently the president.
By the way, you're convinced Hogan's going to run for senator. That's where we are.
Yeah, I mean, if I was him, I'd play it again. I mean, first of all, the guy's as ambitious of a politician as you'll ever meet. He wants to be president of the United States. Look at anybody who was ambitious and not in the U.S. Senate who wanted to be president. What do? They go run for president, right? Kamala, Obama, like,
down
John
line,
Edwards.
Sure.
Down the line, that's what they do. So why wouldn't he? You know, why wouldn't he? He has the money to do it. He doesn't need to telegraph early. If he telegraphs early, it's just going to mean that people like me are going to be, you know, kind of focused, you know, intently and frankly raising money that much easier. But, I mean,
well, let's talk,
he would have to be a moron not to run.
Well, Ben, let's talk about, because this gets
Hogan.
Us,
yeah.
This gets us back to the messaging thing.
I pray
again.
He doesn't, but, you know.
Yeah, this is where I want you to just be real practical.
Sure.
We'll put all the BS aside. One of the things, and I've been in that room trying to come up with great answers, obviously unsuccessfully as well. It fascinates me to this day that simply the word socialist still pushes buttons.
Same thing they use on FDR, same thing that they use on Martin Luther King.
Right.
It's like the oldest trope. Oldest meme in American politics. Yeah, and here's the thing.
Ben Jealous is a socialist.
Infrastructure is socialism.
Socialism.
Yeah, oh.
Roads and bridges
all
are socialism.
All of it, right.
Schools are socialism.
Right, but people in a nice park in a rich neighborhood. Like,
how do Democrats fight that?
We've got to be smarter organizers. I mean, let me just talk to you a second about how Stacey Abrams and I got criminal justice reform passed in Georgia. And it'll just you know, it's easy to say, like, this is a, you know, politics is a continuum. And, you know, if you're in the middle, the assumption is you have, like, the most support. In actuality, voters have deep self-interest. You got to know what that is. And people with certain types of deep self-interest cluster in different places. So if you, with criminal justice reform, for instance, we organized the left of the Georgia legislature, and like the activist left and the activist right. It was the NAACP and the Tea Party. Why? Because on the left, quite frankly, folks who are most motivated by their faith, like really, if you will, by like being involved in ministry, it ultimately drives them into the prisons. We have so many Americans there, and it drives them to be very courageous on criminal justice reform. Turns out the same thing happens on the right. The Christian right, deep in prison ministry, they understand we don't have 1 million black men in prison. We have 1 million white men in prison. We don't just have the most incarcerated black people on the planet. We have the most incarcerated white men on the planet. That's their base, and they understand it's tearing their families apart. So there, then you've got the libertarians, the activist wing of the Republican Party. Honestly, if you say to a libertarian like marijuana reform, you had them at marijuana. Real talk, the libertarians are the pot smoking wing of the Republican Party, and then you have the fiscal conservatives. And Don, if you know the fiscal conservatives tend to not want to be controversial, but if they have the cover of the Christian conservatives and the libertarians, then you have their attention, and they know that like the prison budget is the magic crystal that no one can shrink in the state budget, and it's crushing funding for public higher education and everything else. So we, and otherwise...
And a lot of that money's funneled to private organizations.
Yes, 100%.
But I mean, also, the workers in the school system in Baltimore County are employed by public money. The workers in prisons are being funded and run at the top for profit.
Well,
that's
not all
different. In a lot of cases.
But here was the thing, is we had to get around the private prison lobby, which was the moderates who were addicted to their money in the middle. And so in Georgia, we organized the activist left in the legislature, the activist right. We forged a majority. We had the governor's support. We got it done. Similarly, when you're talking about, you know, I would say, like, how do we win elections? It's not about sort of like the activist wing of the party and the moderates of the party. It's also about the independents.
And I'd say it's very much about the independents.
Because they don't know what they're doing until...
Well, they're 60% of them.
They can be swayed.
Independents want you to fix stuff.
Right.
Right? They want you to fix stuff. They're not convinced government really works. They're not convinced either party's worth a damn. But they know they have a list of things that they want fixed. So one of the reasons why in that 75% of the vote that knew who I was, we were picking up 55 voters for every 100 who knew what I was about. And Hogan was only holding on to 45, was we were for actually fixing the healthcare crisis in this state. And we had a plan for doing that. It turns out you didn't have to have ideas as bold as mine to get people excited. Just simply saying that you were going to create a cooperative, a state-run cooperative, you know, where the state would be the wholesale purchaser of all the pharmaceuticals, would have gotten a ton of support from the independents and from the activist wing. Now, there are other kind of more moderate folks who are afraid of sort of upsetting the apple cart with the insurance companies. But pretty much any small business person will tell you, like, my premiums going up 20% every year is a problem. Or the fact that I can't afford to give my people the health care I want to give them is a problem. Or the fact that this is the number one cause of personal bankruptcy and it's about to take my business under is a problem. And so we had massive energy with the independents. And so when you look at what Youngkin did in Virginia, that's what he did. You take an issue as fallacious as trying to ban Toni Morrison from colleges, right?
Critical race theory.
Yeah, but it's not critical race theory.
Of course not.
It's Toni Morrison telling a story. It's Oprah's book club that you're banning. Like, let's be honest. Critical race theory is three scary words. The Republicans want us to say it as much as possible.
Right.
But what they're really banning is somewhere between black history and, like, English
literature.
But then
they took it to a focus group, and they found that it scared the hell.
Oh, my God.
That
anything
a white
named by a law professor is going to be
scary. Let's just say it. Like, it's that old thing that Biden once said about Rudy Giuliani, right? Noun, verb, and 911. Now it's noun, verb, and critical race theory.
But here's the thing, okay? So they push on that issue, and they get Terry McAuliffe to say, I don't think parents should be telling schools what to do. Right? We've all just gone through COVID. We've all, like, had our kids at school.
Right.
Like, we have all kinds of opinions we want to express. But if
I said he wasn't a good candidate in that way.
Right.
You know, I said you felt bad the day after when you lose if you're a Democrat. He wasn't the right candidate.
No, he wasn't. But here's the thing. What Youngkin did that was smart was that issue of parents should be able to tell their schools, you know, what to do. It plays well with his base.
Yep.
They got all sorts of ideological reasons for that. It plays well with just like a common sense minded independent who's just like, yeah, my school better be responsive to me, my kid's school, right?
That's why we had PTA meetings.
Right, and so he won by speaking to his base and by pulling in the independents. And what we need to do as a party, I would say, is recognize that we have a base and we need them to turn out, and when they don't turn out, we lose. And that increasingly the people who actually we used to imagine as moderates are actually independents. And if we get the base and the independents excited at the same time, then you can win on that. And I'm telling you, in this governor's race, whoever owns the healthcare issue is going to find themselves, like, taking off. I mean, there was a reason when, you know, last time, you know, Hogan would never actually really contradict anything I was saying. I don't know if you know, like, I came out, I said, we should have free community college. He came out with a plan, essentially for free community college. You know, I came out, said, look, you know, the teachers got shortchanged. They you know, told their salaries during the recession, we need to get them back up, you know, to where they were. He came out and said, I'm for teacher wages too. He was
because
doing the polling.
Consistently, Ben, that's the frustrating point. Right about this ad nauseum, people have read me. On almost every issue, save immigration, which I think we just have done a bad job on that, but almost every other issue, the public agrees with Democratic positions overwhelmingly.
Yeah.
Overwhelmingly. We just articulate it badly. And that's why I want you to jump back to your...
And we market it badly.
We market it badly to your criminal justice issue. Because I maintain that this is one of the worst areas. This is one of the areas where the Democrats do themselves the most damage.
Yep.
And that is, I've never met a Democrat who thinks it's okay to have violent crime and people be accosted on the street and have people running into the Walgreens in San Francisco and filling up trash bags and Walgreens having it. I don't know why Democrats are so afraid to say bad guys and bad gals can't be terrorizing our streets.
No, I mean,
it's not a scary thing to say, but we're terrified of
that. That turns into defund the police, though.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. If you lit it, which is like the worst slogan ever created in America, what I say is this. You actually have to do what works. A lot of Democrats, quite frankly, they play to the suburbs. They don't spend a lot of time in the inner city. They don't really think about what works. And they don't want to be part of race baiting, and, you know, thank you for that. We don't need to be part of race baiting. But we do need to be intellectually curious about what's actually going to bring down crime. Here in Baltimore, one thing that we need are gun courts. When I was president of the NAACP, we pushed through a racial profiling ban in New York City. The same time, we pushed through money for gun courts. Why? Because you got to get the guns off
the street.
Tell
folks what a gun court is.
Yeah, okay. So racial profiling, what Bloomberg was doing was literally, go back, Giuliani used to pull over 70,000 black men, principally, like 80, 90%, to get 700 guns off the street. Bloomberg started pulling over 700,000 stop and frisk to get 700 guns off the street. The number of guns didn't go up. You went from a 99% failure rate to a 99.9% failure rate, and you traumatize people and you turn them against the police by the drove. Because, you know, if I'm out on a date with my girlfriend, I'm 18 years old, and you're a cop shoving your hands down my pants, like, we got a problem, you know? And you just assaulted my masculinity for my girlfriend, right? And that was happening every night in Brooklyn and the Bronx. So we got that passed. And at the same time, we need to get more guns off the street. Well, when we looked in the prosecutions, what we saw was a lot of time a trigger puller comes in for a low-level infraction plus a gun. And they end up pleading it out. They minimize the gun infraction. And then you follow this guy through the system, and he's shooting somebody, like, you know, three trips later. And so what we said is, if you create a dedicated gun court with dedicated gun prosecutors where every single gun infraction goes there, then they will deal with the gun crimes as the crimes they are every time. What the criminologist will tell you, and I'm trained in criminology at Oxford, that was where I did my master's work, because my granddad was a probation officer here in the city, and he was my hero.
You would be a cop if you weren't doing this, maybe?
If your life
took you in a different way.
Yeah, no. I mean, I went to sign up to join the Coast Guard, which is a type of cop.
Right.
When I was 26 years old.
Well, it says where your soul is a little bit, right?
Yeah,
I mean, you go off to college to study it, that, you know,
yeah,
you want to fix it.
No, that's exactly right. And my family are, you know, cops to this day. I have family in Maryland this morning who picked up guns and picked up badges and went to work. And we've been in law enforcement in Maryland at least since my granddad, so, you know, 50, 60 years. What I'd say is this. What works is, even more than this, than how many years you send the person away, is you make getting caught certain and you make getting punished certain. What people fear is a disruption to their life. You send me away for 2 years, you just disrupted my life. It really doesn't matter if it's 5 or 10. What I'm really, the math I'm doing in my head is, am I going to get caught? If I get caught, am I going to get punished? And unfortunately, in New York City, for example, until we instituted gun courts, people's assumption was, well, they'll catch me with a gun, but I won't really get punished. It's the same assumption here in Baltimore now. It's why I've always championed gun courts in the city.
Now, I had spoken, this is such an important topic. I said our good buddy Dan Rodericks wrote an article this morning about the increasing crime over in Station North around the Charles Theater and how retail operators over there are for the first time questioning whether they can stay in the city. He writes about the fear of people coming down. Now, for Dan to write that article, and we all know Dan well, that's a tough article because there's no bigger booster for
city.
Baltimore City than Dan Rodericks. Something is happening out there. People hate chaos. I think that goes to the whole message of Virginia and New Jersey as well. Still feels chaotic. Delta made it feel chaotic. We're not coming out on the other side yet. And we've got this whole issue. One of the things that we push.
So what they need in Station North, just to be clear,
go ahead.
Is they need officers walking the beat.
Right.
If officers walk the beat, they will catch those folks. What happened is whenever you start getting a concentration of street traffic, people have some disposable income, you actually ends up, you know, so quote unquote, they say the neighborhood gets better because there's a wealthier clientele, if you will. It also becomes a magnet for anybody who wants to snatch a purse. You know, steal a purse there, right? And so if the cops are in their cars, then in order to give them intelligence, you either have to already have that cop's number, which most people don't, or you have to flag them down, which is a real issue because somebody saw you flag down the cops. But if an officer, you know, if an officer's walking the beat, all you got to do is just go like this, and you can literally, or you can just walk past them and be like, John shot Joe, and just keep on walking. And nobody will know that you spoke to that cop. In San Francisco, two real high crime areas. One, is Bayview Hunters Point. It's isolated from the rest of the city. Drug wars there all the time. The other one is the Tenderloin, much more like Station North. As some of the poorest housing in the city, also has some of the fanciest restaurants and hotels in the city, all in the same place. The homicide rates in both were high. One took a steep dive. Why? Because the restaurant owners and the hotel owners and the store owners and the Tenderloin demanded that they have beat cops walking the beat.
Again, not revolutionary.
It's not. Well, it's just common sense.
Let's pick up on another not revolutionary idea.
By the way, Ben Jealous here. I want to reset here. It's all brought to you by the Maryland Lottery. Let yourself play. We're doing a crab cake tour. My crab cake is getting, it's room temperature.
Look at that sucker.
It's room temperature over here. Just the way Nancy the Bible wants us to. So.
Well, let me just say, my granddad, every Saturday we go buy his lottery tickets. He'd always box his number. And he was always making crab cakes because I would catch the crabs. I've caught maybe tens of thousands of crabs. My son and I are out there with a trot line. We catch a bushel or two most weekends with our neighbor Bill out in Pasadena. I've never eaten a crab in my life.
You said that.
I've never eaten a crab.
Shellfish intolerant? Or you don't even know.
No,
you're just vegan.
I'm a vegetarian. I'm just a normal. I eat cheese. I eat eggs. I gotta tell you, as like a black guy who's 48 and has like blood pressure that same blood pressure I had when I was 20. Like, I don't want any grease in my veins now, but I wish I had tried a crab at some point.
Well, I have one last thing on criminal justice. Then I want to talk about national politics because, man, I have trouble sorting it all out. Yeah. We hear over and over from experts that one of the things the state could do, and you would have been the governor, is to really ramp up the office of parole and probation.
Yeah.
That we know who these folks are. First of all, we do a lousy job of getting people ready when they come out. We hear that all the time. We just basically throw them back out on the street without any job training, without any counseling, without any connections.
I mean, Larry Hogan's done real damage to the criminal justice infrastructure of our state. You just got to go out to any of the prisons on the Eastern Shore and you see it. Last time I was out there, it seemed like the guards...
I got a nephew that's a guard down there.
Yeah. And the conditions are terrible. The inmates are at their wits' end. The guards are at their wits' end. The families are at their wits' end. The guards have been working mandatory overtime. People act like somehow if you're a prison guard, like you can magically work mandatory overtime for we even tell ourselves that they want it. No, you know what people want? People want to make enough money, come home, and still have energy to play with their kid, to raise their family. And, Governor Hogan has treated these people like essentially his colonial servants and has completely abused them. And I've been to a lot of prisons in this country. My work as a criminal justice reformer, I've been to few that are as much of a tinderbox as he has made the ones out on the Eastern Shore. And God bless
my cousin. I was saying it was my nephew. It's my cousin.
Yeah, God bless your nephew for hanging in there.
Yeah. No, it's hard. I think about him. There's a lot of Thanksgivings he can't come because he's working another shift or he has to be on. So the things you're describing are real.
And they often give them no warning.
Right.
Right. He may have told you the day before I can be at Thanksgiving, and suddenly he can't be there.
Exactly.
Yeah. What do I need to know about prison? I've never been to one. Never been in one.
I was back in one a couple of weeks ago for a protest outside the White House, the D.C. City Jail, and they just shut it down for being inhabitable. But I think what you have to understand is this. You go back. We began expanding prisons in the late 60s when there was deindustrialization as a way of dealing with massive unemployment. You start increasing who's behind bars. That's taking people out of the economy, start warehousing people. But also you had people who were old factory workers. And this is certainly true up and down the Eastern Shore. A lot of guys are prison guards now. They used to work in factories. Or if they're younger, their father used to work in the factory. The factories are gone. The prisons became the new factories throughout rural America. Governor Rockefeller up in New York kind of set that example. He said there will be a community college in every county, and basically in every rural county there would be a prison. And those were, or the small counties, one that would draw from three or four to employ people. So, that's, one. The second thing I think you really need
to
understand.
Do you really rehabilitate people?
No, that's the second thing, right? Is that we need to take an interest because 85% of the folks come back.
Right.
And
85.
Yeah, and they come back more broken. They come back often pushed into a gang for survival.
And if they come out again, they come back again.
Yeah, and in Baltimore, folks who are coming back either from the city jail historically or from the prison, protected by certain gangs, and they're given a list of what CVSs are easy to rob because they got to pay for the protection that they received. right? So when my cousin was working for the FBI, downtown Baltimore, and a CVS.
I mean, this is very wiry stuff that, you know, yeah. we don't hear
first
every day.
First place they go, if a bank is robbed in Baltimore, like a simple like teller robbery, is the bus stop. Because it's usually robbed by somebody who's just out of prison, hasn't had time to get a car, and they're trying to pay mm-hmm. off the gang before the gang does them or their family real harm. You know, the other thing I would say...
That's a hell of a documentary you just pictured there. You know?
Yeah, the other thing I'd say...
Follow these people when they leave the prison, and what happens in the first 48 hours, right?
Yeah, well, and there's a ton of corruption inside of our prisons. What we saw at the Baltimore City Jail and 40 officers, was that 6, 7, 8 years ago getting prosecuted? Just the tip of the iceberg. When I was a young reporter in Mississippi, I was investigating corruption at the state pen. They literally had, they estimated significant 6 figures of forged, this is back in the day, forged money orders coming out of the prison every month. Now, the only way to create those money orders was with colored pencils. Colored pencils, when you sharpen them, leave the evidence everywhere, right? They could never stop it. They could never stop it because obviously there were either guards or contractors who were involved in getting them everything in and out, getting the pencils in and out. Getting the money orders in and out. So there's a tremendous amount of corruption. I think the most important thing is that every one of our young people is paying a price. And just stick with me here for a second. Understand this. All right. Maryland, when my grandfather went to the University of Maryland School of Law, the tuition was $200. It really wasn't tuition. It was like fees. $200, it was like 1950s. Today it costs about $40,000. If that $200 had kept it with inflation, it'd be about $3,000. Well, what happened? Well, what happened is between 1970 and today, the last 50 years, state after state, spending the subsidy for public higher education has gone down as the spending on prisons has gone up. Now, now in most states, what we spend on our public universities is a fraction of what we spend on our prisons. You go back 50 years, what we spent on our prisons was a fraction of what we spent on our universities. It's flip-flopped. And how does that impact every kid? Well, it impacts every kid like this. Either, you know, you're between 18 and 35 and you're in prison. That's a bulk of people in prison. Or you're between 18 and 35 and you're in a public university and you're either getting more debt or your family's burning up more of your inheritance, you know, on the cost than they would have been. Or you're in a private university that is now charging more because the public university is charging more. So, of course, the private university will charge more. Or you've decided, I can't afford to go to college. And then you don't get the salary bump. Or you're the worst guy who started like 2 years of college, so you have the debt, but then you couldn't afford to finish the degree and you don't get the salary bump either. But you have the debt. And that's what our young people are dealing with. And it fundamentally starts because, you know, we have not been curious about our criminal justice policy. We have not insisted that our criminal justice policy perform. We are happy to basically imagine that the people that we are scared of are being kept away from us, but they're not. They're actually being trained in these prisons to come back worse because we're not training them to come back better. And the idle, you know, and as my grandmother said,
yeah, I think they're in college over there. And they're then I watched, you know, Scared Straight 50 years ago and saw what it was like then. And any image I get out of it now, it doesn't look a whole lot different in that way, right? I mean, what is the qualification to graduate from prison? I mean, that's always my question. What do you
time? Time and
there's no other barrier than time.
Yeah, no. I mean, you know, time and your behavior, right? Which is the behavior, of course, that you're caught for. There's a lot of things that go down that you're just not going
to. But not your behavior as to how you're going to react on the street.
No, or your preparation.
No one's pre-qualifying them for street behavior.
Right.
Yeah.
No, that's exactly right.
This has been a powerful discussion. I knew it would be. Before we let you run. And it's another whole show. Maybe you can just give us a quick summary. I was so troubled this week, Ben, by a Republican congressman putting out a picture of him slashing Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez's throat. And not one Republican in Congress stepping forward to say that's unacceptable. At the same time, they did step forward to say we ought to kick people off of committees who voted for infrastructure in the United States. Talk me out of my depression. How do we go forward?
And the same Republicans, they won't celebrate the officers that risk their lives to stop an insurrection.
Well, they're the Law and Order Party, and they're okay with and people getting beaten with flagsticks.
Cops getting beaten up.
So how do we turn this around, Ben?
I mean, you know, we... The Democratic Party has to have the courage to be the party of working people again. We are losing men. Most notably white men, but we are earning a smaller and smaller percentage of black men's votes, of Latinos' men's vote, because men...
I think that's a trend Democrats better pay attention
to. We have to pay huge attention to. Here's the thing. Men, we are ultimately defined in our families by our ability to provide. And we have had a couple generations of men in West Baltimore and South Baltimore just generally feeling like it's way harder to provide than it was for my grandfather, right? You know, I live in Pasadena part because the old, what was it called? Oh, it's coming. Anyways, there was an old black vacation community down on the Magathy where my grandparents used to go. Beechwood Park.
Okay.
Beechwood Park, right? But I'm surrounded by a whole bunch of people whose families are from Dundalk, right? And the grandparents bought houses down there. And they had a house in Dundalk. They had a summer house in Pasadena. It was a great life. And you could do that without a college education. But it's harder and harder to do that. And we as a party, I think, first and foremost, cannot be so addicted to corporate support that we're unwilling to actually put forward a vision.
But you needed $10 million, and that's why you didn't get elected.
Yeah. That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Well, we go back to the beginning of the conversation.
It's really, really difficult.
Yeah,
but you're right. And the Democrats, and this is not a novel Don Mohler idea. It's obviously being written about every day. Do we have to show up in rural communities and working class communities? Can't just write them off. When you ran for governor, you didn't just write off Cumberland. You didn't write off Ocean City, right? I mean, you showed up. You tried to communicate.
Yeah, no, I mean, 100%. I was the only – it was so funny, the teachers' convention was happening the same weekend as the pancake breakfast for the local Ocean City Democratic Club. All of us were there. I was the only one who showed up, you know?
Right.
My father met my mom teaching at Harlan Park Junior High here in West Baltimore. My dad's from rural Maine. That's where his family is. And it's a lot like Western Maryland. You know, the most beautiful cousin on the wife side of the family, she's in her 30s, auburn hair, green eyes. First she was addicted to meth, now she's addicted to opiates. You know, like, there is a pain amongst working class black folks and white folks that mirrors what the other side's going through. You know, black men and boys, we're afraid of dying from bullets, from homicide. You and I have had very tough conversations about about white men that we've known, older white men who've taken their lives
right.
with suicide. It turns out that the rate of death from suicide amongst white men over 50 is higher than it is for homicide, black men 15 to 30. But we're not having that conversation.
Right.
And so, I mean, I think fundamentally, the Democratic Party has to get back to being the party of working people again. You know, some folks say, don't worry about working class white men. Why are you trying to court them? No, it's like, look, honestly, if you don't have a vision for working-class white men, it means you don't have a vision for the economy.
It's everybody.
I mean, it means that you don't have a vision for women as workers.
Right, right.
Black people as workers.
We got to stop putting people in silos.
Yes.
It's everybody.
And we got to make sure that we can lift all boats.
And Nestor, there it is.
You're the first guy we've had, I think, on the Crab Cake Tour that is not a Crab Cake person. Right? So Jamie Raskin. Jamie Raskin's vegan. We had another. Calvin Ball does not.
Right.
He's shellfish intolerant.
Yeah.
So we have some of that.
I will challenge either one of those guys to a contest.
Here's the thing, and I tell Damien this.
Calvin, Jamie, I will meet you out.
Standing by.
I'll meet you out on the Magathy.
People say, why the crab cake tour? I even got a guy here that doesn't eat crab cakes.
I will catch more bushels than you, hands down.
You don't
hands
even need
down.
To eat crab cakes to be on the crab cake tour.
We have lost control.
We got room for everybody.
Ben Jealous, People for the American Way. Take us out of here.
It's all brought to you by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. I got masks here. I got koozies here. We're going to be at Nick's Grandstand Grill on Friday. We're going to be at Coco's on next Wednesday with our mayor, Brandon Scott. And right now we're at Fadley's. We're going to come back, get some more here. Vegetables. Look at these vegetables here for Ben Jealous. Are those beets? What is that? I don't like beets. My pickled beets. Got mac and cheese. We got macaroni and cheese, potato salad, cucumber a salad, coleslaw, and collard greens. I was going to say it was kale. I'm not sure it was. I turned your microphone down because you're talking to people off the mic. Jeez. I'm trying to keep this thing
all right,
under control.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I'm Nestor. We are WNST. AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking. Baltimore positive. I've lost control.